From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey on the lawsuit she's filed against Betsy DeVos and the U.S. Department of Education over a rule entitling students to loan forgiveness.
What she did was illegal. It violates the Administrative Procedures Act. And more importantly, it's unfair.
Also, what's happening or not on Beacon Hill with the state budget.
They need to get something to our desk so that we can review it and respond accordingly and get going.
Later, the benefits of summer jobs for teens in Boston beyond a paycheck. Plus, get a letter in the mail that your town's electricity provider is changing. You might want to read it before you trash it.
What these communities are doing, they made a choice as a community to add more renewable energy. The consumers can opt out.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. We're now 6 days into the state's new fiscal year, and Massachusetts lawmakers are still deadlocked on passing a new budget. We'll have a full update on Beacon Hill and the budget battle in a few moments. But first, we want to check in with WBUR's Asma Khalid. She leads the station's new business and tech team, or biz and tech team, called Bostonomics. Hey, Asma.
Hi, Jill.
Welcome. Let's start with some business news, which is about GE settling into Boston in the last few months. The stock market is not loving this company today.
That's right, Jill. And I would say that this is kind of a symbolic move, but to me, it was so notable. So GE's stock, as this afternoon, just before we came in here, was trading at the lowest percentage, you know, sort of lowest mark that it's been at all year. It was down to $26.18. I don't know if it's changed in the last few minutes. But in a nutshell, Jill, this is to me really interesting and symbolic because the stock hasn't been doing well for a while. I mean, people who've been sort of following this news will know that GE had this CEO, very famous CEO, Jeff Immelt, who during his tenure, the stock price had fallen about 30%. And this is kind of notable because the Dow Jones and the overall stock market, you know, hasn't been doing as poorly. And when Jeff Immelt resigned recently and stepped down, the new CEO came in and on a call with investors, he acknowledged that really something needs to be done to improve the stock price. So this has been an ongoing problem. I think what happened today is that there was an analyst at JP Morgan who essentially came out with a pretty kind of I would call it kind of a doom and gloom scenario around GE. He just said that essentially they were dropping their target price down to about $22, that he essentially felt the company had not really lived up to expectations up to this point and didn't anticipate sort of huge growth moving forward.
Okay, so I don't want to act as anybody who's giving out a stock tip, but was this though anticipated, and couldn't this just be a one-day bad shot, or does this have to do with being an old company, an older company, being in Boston at all? Versus where it was?
So Jill, I would say that, you know, many folks will say that the move to Boston in many ways was really the right direction for the company to head. It's trying to pivot. It's trying to engage more in sort of the digital innovation ecosystem. And there's just a lot more talent to tap into here within the Boston ecosystem. But GE stock has really been battling headwinds for a long time. So I would say that this is sort of symbolically the next move, right? It's the lowest share price of the year. But by and large, I would say that there are, I think even the folks at JP Morgan, you know, referenced the fact that there is this new CEO. He will likely set the course moving forward, and we'll sort of have to see what direction he takes the company.
Okay, so a time of transition. Let's talk about the state budget in Massachusetts, also in transition. There is no state budget yet or agreed upon one. One source of expected additional revenue was a new rule calling for out-of-state online retailers to start collecting tax. So that's more revenue. 6.25% sales tax starting July 1st. But what's going on?
But Jill, it didn't actually go into effect as planned. I actually did a story on this a couple weeks ago when folks were anticipating that this new rule would go into effect. And so, Jill, I don't know if you're a big online shopper, but if you are, and you go online to certain companies that don't have a physical store in the state, say like Overstock.com, you might notice when you check out, the tax will look like it's $0. And that's because, you know, we independently are supposed to pay that sales tax. Many shoppers don't know that, and they don't do that. So the state says that there's been a lot of uncollected revenue this way. The governor's governor's office estimated that it would have brought in roughly $30 million for the next fiscal year if they could essentially ensure that these out-of-state online retailers were collecting the tax. Long story short, what happened is the state was sued by this umbrella group of e-commerce sites, sort of arguing with the way that the state was interpreting the law. And they've now decided we're going to revoke this. We're going to sort of promulgate a regulation. I know this is really wonky, but stay with me. Essentially, it'll just allow it, they say, to stand up a little bit more effectively in court.
So here's what I'm not sure if I understand. When you talk about a physical presence, so Amazon is online largely, but now more and more there are these warehouses or pickup slots. So the state is still making the case about a physical presence. I don't quite get that.
It is. And it's a really sort of interesting way. I should say, some people may say it's innovative. Others sort of think it's a shameless tax grab. It depends on who you're talking to. But essentially, they decided that, they wanted to sort of come up with an internet solution to an internet problem, which is this idea of what it means to have a physical presence. And so the state has decided that essentially, if you are online shopping and say you download an app to your phone, or you have those cookies, which are the little bits of data, that track where you're searching, those essentially constitute physical presence. This is not something that really stands up with a lot of the sort of e-commerce sites. I spoke to Steve Del Bianco. He leads Net Choice. It's this umbrella group, one of the organizations that sued the state, and he really takes issue with this logic.
You can't argue that accessing a website is equivalent to giving that website a physical presence in your state.
Yeah. So, essentially, Jill, I think we'll have to see how this plays out. But the Massachusetts Department of Revenue told me that they are planning on just reintroducing this in a different legal way so that it will stand up in court more effectively.
It's interesting to watch after so many years now of shopping online that we're still getting to this point, but we're not quite at the point. Mm-hmm. Asma, I want to move on to what is considered some real buzz this week, which is the culture and sexism in the venture capital world, not just on the West Coast. There's been a lot of splash after some high-profile allegations of discrimination and even assault in Silicon Valley. And that has sparked a reaction here in Boston's VC community. So what is going on? What is the story?
So, Jill, the most sort of immediate direct reaction that we saw here was the New England Venture Capital Association put together this anti-discrimination and sexual harassment statement. The New England Venture Capital Association is an umbrella group, and it actually had all 70 of its member firms sign on to this. This was, I believe, June 27, so a little while back. But I would say that it was an interesting statement to me. I spoke with Jeff Busking. He's a board member of the New England Venture Capital Association. And he told me he really wanted to make sure that this wasn't just going to be a statement and a couple of tweets, that it would actually lead to some sort of effective change. And he told me that, part of what we need to understand is that the way that the VC investment community is set up, it's set up in a way that really doesn't have a lot of traditional HR oversight. And he described the problem in the industry this way to me.
So when you combine those two factors, the lack of HR function with the fact that there's no clear structural relationship between the parties that interact with each other for the purpose of fundraising, it leads to a lack of oversight.
Asma, what does the statement say that they put out?
So the statement was really in reaction to this this gentleman, his name is Justin Kaldback. He's the co-founder of this VC firm called Binary Capital. In a nutshell, there were some really sort of predatory, I would say, behavior that he was accused of. And part of what I think stung really hard here in the Massachusetts VC community was that he used to work at Bain Capital. And by all accounts, from what I have heard, people are not saying that this sort of behavior was existing or that there's any allegations of this when he was on the East Coast. But there are those allegations from when he's now had his own firm out on the West. And what they told me is that really beyond, though, the statement that they did, the New England Venture Capital Association, they actually want to have some sort of effective change. And so they said that they're in the process of having conversations where essentially women can come together, share their stories. A lot of people don't really know what it's like to be a woman entrepreneur in some of these communities. And then they also want to have trainings and then essentially bring on board gender experts. Here's Jeff Busking again.
In many of our companies, there are experts in product development and experts in growth marketing. And it seems to us that it's time to put forward some experts in gender discrimination and sexual harassment.
So, Jill, essentially he's saying that, you know, he understands that really there's no HR institution, right, within VC firms to deal with this. But we have, he said, in the VC community, a lot of experts when it comes to sort of scientific products and whatnot. And he thinks the same should be the case regarding gender issues. Maybe there's some sort of intermediate third party. I asked him how that's really going to happen. And he says they're in the process of figuring this all out. But he seemed optimistic. I mean, he said the Boston VC world is significantly smaller than Silicon Valley and New York. But in some ways, you've been able to see sort of a greater collective community response because everybody kind of knows everybody else.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it just hasn't, you know, like other industries. I mean, it's not an industry, right? As you said, there's no HR that you can't just assume that there'd be an assimilation of good, you know, of good practices on this.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things, Jill, to me that's really interesting is I've sort of asked a few folks about what is it? How would you characterize the culture here in Boston? And one of the things that I heard from somebody that I thought was very interesting is they said, you know, Boston's a little bit different than the Bay. It's subtle. It's maybe not assault. It's maybe not illegal behavior, but it's bad behavior. And a lot of folks know that it's been going on.
Okay. We have just a little bit of time to talk about one more thing today. I know you wanted to talk about the gig economy. And first, I need to know what the gig economy is and some new data that tells us more about who is working the jobs in the gig economy.
Okay.
So who are the gig workers?
So the gig workers, think of people who drive for Uber, Lyft, maybe have an Airbnb or sometimes do TaskRabbit, which is this app where you can sort of hire somebody to help you put up your bookshelves and whatnot. It's essentially sort of people who are doing what you would call second jobs or side hustles, maybe, because their main job doesn't essentially provide enough. But the thing, Jill, is that for some people, it isn't essentially a side hustle. For some folks, it is actually their main source of income. And what interested me is that this type of work has become increasingly popular, particularly as sort of the economy was unpredictable. The Pew Research Center estimates that about a quarter of people right now are participating in this sharing economy. But what interested me is actually how much money they're making. I think there have been a lot of question marks about what amount of sort of financial revenue people gain from this type of employment. And there was new data this week from the online lender Earnest that said the vast majority of people working side gigs, about 85%, make less than $500 a month.
So that's not a whole lot to live on in the city of Boston.
No. And I mean, we should have a, you know, right, of course, this is not necessarily Boston specific. It is nationwide data. And it's very plausible that people here could be making more money. But I think that overall, hearing national numbers like that really give us, you know, a moment to think. One quick last thing on that is that I do want to mention it's something that we at Bostonomics have been thinking a lot about, and we're actually working on a series of stories for hopefully later this summer that are going to look at the future of work and try to tackle some of those issues.
Great. Well, we look forward to hearing more and learning more from you. WBUR's Asma Khalid leads the station's new business and tech team, Bostonomics. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, take care. As we mentioned, Massachusetts still does not have a budget. State lawmakers have been at loggerheads over finalizing the budget for this fiscal year, and they appear to be deadlocked over changes to the marijuana legalization law. Governor Charlie Baker wants both bills on his desk soon.
Well, I'm not one to tell the legislature how to do their job. I just want some progress on executing on the job, which means I would hope that sometime soon we'll see a budget and a bill on marijuana.
For the latest on the political wrangling on Beacon Hill, we're joined by Lauren Dzensky. She's a reporter for Politico Massachusetts. Welcome. You're someone I read almost every day. I just want you to know that.
Oh, thank you so
much.
We haven't
met before. Massachusetts is one of six states without a budget. We know this. But what are the sticking points here?
So essentially, we have the confluence of a couple different deadlines, some actual and real, and others semi-manufactured. The state has to produce a new budget ahead of the fiscal year, which ended on June 30th. And then we also had the self-imposed deadline of the rewrite of the marijuana law that legislators said that they wanted to see something new. This is a change of the ballot question that a majority of Massachusetts residents voted for and passed back in November. 6 days later, neither a new budget nor a rewrite of the marijuana law have materialized.
So from what you've seen on Beacon Hill in the past and from other times of year in other states, is it unusual to have a budget that hasn't passed and a very important conversation about a new law that takes you into very different places when it comes to substance use.
Sure.
That had formerly been illegal.
Right. Absolutely. It's not strange to have a supplemental budget, which was passed this far before the deadline. Basically, the state has funded through the end of this month. So when we talk about the budget deadline, there's a deadline to file a new budget. But when you are in charge of making the laws, you can also adapt certain things. And so when you look at the brinksmanship that's happening in other states, you know, these other five states, Massachusetts is slightly different because we don't have to worry about our beaches necessarily being shut down because we've at least got everything funded through the end of the year. What is unprecedented?
Funded through the end of 2017.
I'm sorry, the end of the month.
The end of the month. Through July. Yeah. So that's not a whole lot. I mean, that's like 3 weeks to go, 3.5 weeks to go.
Right.
So no state shut down, but what if lawmakers do not come to a decision, even with Governor Baker's demanding words that we just heard?
and it's interesting because other governors have demanded more of their legislatures. They could just as easily pass another supplemental budget to fund the state through another month. Back in 2001, we actually saw supplemental budgets passed up until it was through October of 2001. So the governor wasn't signing a new budget for the new fiscal year until that November, which is much later. What was unprecedented that we saw yesterday was House Speaker Robert DeLeo said that, oh, the impasse with the Marijuana Conference Committee is getting in the way of passing a new budget. We must suspend the Marijuana Conference Committee, which is in charge of rewriting this law.
Right. And Stan Rosenberg, Senate President, he's like, what was the term that he used?
Mischief makers.
These are two press releases that came out overnight, woke up to find them. So what happened today? Was there any negotiation then on the marijuana bill?
No. As far as we know, it's suspended. It's hard to say because people who have been around Beacon Hill for a long time, you can be there for 30 years and still be relatively new. Everyone is saying that this move yesterday and this kind of strange impasse that we're seeing today is unprecedented and is strange. And so the feeling today is kind of we don't know still what next steps are going to happen. Obviously, the budget is the priority. It's just a question of when and how that is ironed out. But it doesn't seem like that's going to happen by the end of this
week. So where do personalities play in this? I mean, is it a power struggle between Rosenberg and DeLeo?
Yes.
Senate and House. I mean,
yes.
And what do you know? What do you know?
So basically, we've seen this before where despite the fact that we have a Republican governor and a Democratic Senate president and a Democratic Speaker of the House, we're seeing more conflict between the House and Senate, which are both largely Democratic, which is fascinating to watch. And we're also seeing Governor Baker, the lone Republican, kind of stepping back a little bit. You know, he's not the one who's putting up these harsh deadlines. He's not pulling a Chris Christie and saying, well, you must figure this out right now. This is a slightly different tactic. So we are seeing the Democrats kind of hash it out a little bit.
So but remind us, if you know, Lauren, where did the governor lean when it came to this marijuana bill? If let's say there's a personality, he's part of the triangle there. The Senate basically wants the voter-approved law to remain intact when it comes to taxing legally sold marijuana. The House is pushing for a much sharper increase in the state tax, so that's more revenue, and that gives local towns and cities something else. The voters, you know, this is not what the voters called for. So where is Baker on this?
So that's a great question. Baker has basically said he wants enough money to fund the new regulatory structure. There was somewhat of an understanding that the tax rate as the ballot question that was approved, so it's now the law, that 13% wasn't enough. So the House proposal that increased that tax rate, it's generally understood that Baker was more supportive of that House proposal. As well, he's also generally supportive of local cities and towns being able to call the shots. So the local control provision of the ballot question is
Lauren,
also...
would you say that is that part of the holdup then?
Yeah, it's one of... They're saying that it's 20% of differences between... they grant 80% of the law. 20% is what that is.
Lauren Dzinski is a reporter for Politico Massachusetts. You can read her just about every day, I think. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, the impact of youth summer jobs, that summer jobs for teens. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. The summer is in full swing, but for many young people, sitting in a classroom is the new cool spot. And that is because more of them are opting for educational programs instead of summer jobs. So this comes as a new study out of Northeastern University reveals the impact summer youth employment programs have on young people and rates of crime. This morning, Mayor Marty Walsh held an orientation for 2,000 young people who are set to begin new jobs through the city's summer jobs program. He told a crowd at BU's arena right across the street from where we are here in the studio that each of them has the potential to change the future.
Everyone in this auditorium, deep inside of you, should have a dream to do something in life. I don't care what that dream is. Pursue your dream. You're all from Boston. You're tough. You are the future. The young people in front of me are the future.
You are the future. Joining us now to talk about the future of summer jobs and otherwise is the author of the study from Northeastern University, Alicia Sasser-Modestino, Associate Director of the Dukakis Center at Northeastern. Hello.
Hi.
And please tell me if I pronounced your last name correctly.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
And Neil Sullivan, Executive Director of the Boston Private Industry Council, or PIC for short. PIC works to connect youth in Boston with employment opportunities. Welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
So, Alicia Modestino, tell us first about the study. And what did you look at? And what did you find? And did you find anything new?
Yeah, so we looked at participants in the summer jobs program from the summer of 2015, and we used a randomized control design, meaning that there are more kids who apply to the summer jobs program than there are summer jobs to employ them with. And so that allowed us to have a group of students who participated in the program and also a control group who was just like them, but who unfortunately did not get to participate. For research purposes, this is great because then we could follow the two groups over time. And what we found is that in the 17 months after participating in the program, violent crime was 35% lower in the treatment group and property crime was 57% lower in the treatment group after participating.
And what, when you say the other group, were they did they have summer jobs? Was there any, they weren't in an organized program, but what were they doing?
Yeah, so about 25% of those in the control group who didn't get to participate in the summer jobs program were able to find jobs on their own, which means 75% did not. And so that really indicates how hard it is for youth to find their own job in Greater Boston, even though the unemployment rate is extremely low. And so most of those kids did not have a job during the summer. Some were probably doing school or education-related programs, as you suggested. But again, we found that not very many of them were able to find jobs on their own.
And who were these kids, though? I mean, what backgrounds did they come from? And I think that's important when we talk about the data that you gathered and what you've come up with.
Yeah, this is extremely important. So these were mostly low-income youth. So they came from households where about one in five received public assistance. About one in five was from a single-parent household, high-share non-white minority youth. And so, for these individuals living in neighborhoods that we see high rates of crime, not a lot of job opportunities, in some cases failing schools, having a summer job is a really important experience for them and can really open a lot of doors.
Neil Sullivan, I want to get you in on this too.
Yeah.
As the executive director of the Boston Private Industry Council, you're working with the companies to connect them to kids. Is that right? Like, are you the tunnel of some of times money and sometimes just connecting companies with kids?
Well, what comes through the tunnel are Boston Public High School students who we have identified, prepared, and matched with private sector jobs and internships. So the companies are paying the wage, but it's a lot more than the paycheck, though that is the hook. That's what brings the students our way. But once they're on the work site, there's a supervisor, often a mentor, who is working on skill development while trying to get good work done in the months of July and August, working on skills like communication, collaboration, critical thinking, problem solving, skills we know are important but don't necessarily fit into the traditional high school curriculum. So we've always thought of summer jobs as a way to stay busy and out of trouble, but in Boston, particularly under Mayor Walsh, it's been more of a summer of work and learning. And we're often accommodating, you know, summer school style learning opportunities, but it's not the summer school of the past. It's more of an integrated work and learning experience.
Right. And to be sure, there are many types of programs in the city of Boston and other cities in greater Boston that are connecting teens to jobs, whether that's through the Y or through a community center.
Yeah.
The Shannon Grants are a whole other story of recent. And the state has its other projects. But
right.
Is there anything?
I'm talking specifically about the employer-paid,
yes,
employer-supervised jobs. So that's the PIC component of the Mayor's Summer Jobs
Program.
Very
specific handle on that. Neil Sullivan, is there anything in the study out of Northeastern that Alicia Modestino ran, is there anything that surprised you? Because we keep looking at teens and summertime, and you know, there's little flags that go up when there's too much time on one's hands.
Not surprising, but you know, heartbreaking. There's 40% less employment for young people today as compared to the turn of the century, barely 20 years ago. I mean, the teen employment rate has dropped in Massachusetts from 52% to 31%. It's an enormous loss of learning time. I mean, we don't necessarily think of the summer jobs we once had as learning time, until we think about it and think about all the things that we learned there that we wouldn't have learned anywhere else. You know, we as policymakers and practitioners need to come up with broader strategies for helping young people become, you know, work-ready, career-focused. That's a lot of what's necessary when it comes to academic motivation. Students always ask, why am I doing this? Summer jobs help you understand
mm-hmm.
why.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's often a thing also, why do we push kids to be in chorus even? Why do we push kids to get onto a stage and perform? And there's a lot of skills that are developed in many of these, whether they're extracurricular events or getting that summer job. But in the study, Dr. Modestino, does your research inform that public policy in the future that Neil Sullivan just referenced, like how we do encourage and connect? Because there's an issue here of jobs being available. More people are staying longer in the workforce. There are more elders in the workforce, or there may not be an interest in taking the summer job. This is separate from, you know, Boston PIC connecting employers to kids. This is beyond, you know, beyond this very small group. So what can we learn from the research you've done?
Yeah, so I think there's two things that are going on. First, I think there are two different parts of the youth labor market. There's the part of the youth labor market that, you know, maybe I was in when I was a youngster, that, you know, was college bound, was working in the summer to save some money and things like that. And that part of the youth labor market right now is often doing enriching types of activities that you mentioned before, right? So they're doing specialized camps or unpaid internships or other types of experiences. And I don't worry so much about those kids. But then there's another part of the teen labor market that wants to work and that needs to work. And so some of the research that we did even before this study showed that half of teens who want a job often can't find a job, and about half of them say that it's the first job that they're looking for. So there's definitely some barriers to being able to get into the labor market, and a lot of this has to do with, you know, changes in the kinds of jobs that are out there, right? You know, there's no more blockbusters out there. We get all of our TV and our movies on demand now, right? So a lot of the jobs that teenagers used to do just aren't there. You know, folks are taking those kinds of jobs. Like we have a lot of immigrants who take some of the landscaping type jobs, and older folks who are also taking those types of jobs. So there's just fewer experiences out there. And for a kid, though, that's not college bound, that's a really important experience to have before you leave high school. And as Neil was mentioning, it teaches all sorts of different skills. So the one thing that was really new about our study was that we were able to link improvements in social skills like resolving conflict with a peer, learning to manage one's emotions, feeling like you had something to contribute to your community, and feeling connected to your neighborhood. Kids who showed big improvements in those skills were the ones who saw the biggest reduction in crime.
And is there anything that is unique about that to Boston? Boston versus cities that have higher crime rates, and I know the city of Boston has a record low percentage number of on the murder rate, which is separate from other crime rates. But is this unique to Boston? And we have about a minute left.
Yeah, one of the things that's unique to Boston is the development of a career readiness curriculum that's used throughout the summer jobs program, and that's something that other cities are looking to emulate as well. And so we can't exactly disentangle whether or not it's this career readiness curriculum or the job experience that's giving kids these skills, or actually probably a combination of both, where you get to learn that skill and then practice it on the job. But I do know that other cities like Philadelphia and L.A. have been in touch with us and are looking at our study very carefully to think about whether or not they want to incorporate that kind of curriculum into their program.
All right. Thank you so much. I wish we could go on longer. I just have to say my first summer job, I believe, as a teen was in a photomat booth, which cannot exist anymore possibly on this planet. Alicia Sasser-Modestino, thank you. Associate Director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy at Northeastern, and Neil Sullivan, the Executive Director of the Boston Private Industry Council. Good work both of you doing for a lot of teens out there. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having us.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Stay with us. Coming up, a conversation with Attorney General Maura Healey, plus changes to your energy supplier. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. 18 states and the District of Columbia, led by Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, have filed suit against U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education that she leads. The suit alleges that DeVos illegally delayed protections for students who were cheated by colleges that acted fraudulently. The AG joins us now by phone. Attorney General Healey, great to have you back on Radio Boston. Tell us why you're bringing this lawsuit.
Well, it's great to be with you. For the last few years, my office and other offices have investigated and worked to shut down the worst of these actors, these predatory for-profit schools. And in addition to that, we also worked very closely over the last 2 years with the Department of Education to develop a rule that would be in place to make sure that students and taxpayers are treated fairly. This is the borrower defense rule that was supposed to go into effect July 1st. And the borrower defense rule basically says that if schools cheat students, then the federal government is not going to continue to make it easy for them to access federal loan dollars. It also says that if schools are breaking the law and harming students by lying about job placement, graduation, or default rates, for example, then students who've been the victim of those unfair predatory practices could apply for relief from unaffordable loans, and that the state was going to have law enforcement authority to help those students get discharges of those loans. What Betsy DeVos did is pull the rug out from under us with no notice and announced that she was going to delay that rule that had been carefully crafted and worked on for the last 2 years. And what she did was illegal. It violates the Administrative Procedures Act. And more importantly, it's unfair. It makes no sense. Unfortunately, though, we have a Secretary of Education and Betsy DeVos who's more interested in protecting the executives of for-profit schools than actually protecting the students whose responsibility is that her office takes care of. And that's what's happened, and that's why the states, there were 19 of us in all, filed the lawsuit that we filed today to keep that from happening. We want to see the law implemented, the rule implemented, so that students can have access to the relief that they're due.
Have you seen anything, and do you expect that it will be completely counter or somewhat counter to what you created under the Barack Obama administration?
Well, delay just means, in our view, deny. Delay is another way of them canceling the rule effectively. We think that that's what they plan to do. And So a delay basically is tantamount to canceling of a rule, and it's just simply not the right course, and it violates the law for the Secretary of Education to do this. And so this is why we've sued. The loans we're talking about, they are loans that are sizable. We're talking about tens of thousands, in some instances, hundreds of thousands of dollars that students owe. And we know through our investigations and cases that for far too long there's been an open spigot, and these for-profit schools have been able to access federal loan dollars on the backs of vulnerable students by specifically targeting them and marketing them through high-pressure sales tactics.
You mean to take out loans that they can't afford?
They shouldn't afford for programs that simply don't don't bear out. Many of these schools spend 90% of their dollars marketing to students, and they offer them the promise of great jobs, great careers, when our investigations have showed that they've actually lied about the kinds of internships and jobs available to students. They've lied about the kinds of courses and the caliber of teachers available to these students. And in some instances, we've seen some of these schools simply go bankrupt, belly up, and leave these students high and dry, stuck with
paying
significant
off
debt.
Loans, so, right. Is there any other time that you know of that a state attorney general's office or a group of states have sued the Department of Education?
I'm not sure in recent history that I'm aware of a case, but this is a very important case to bring. I mean, just yesterday, my office announced a new settlement with DeVry University, which is an online for-profit school, for close to $500,000. And it's just one of a string of cases we've brought against these for-profit colleges. And this rule that the Department of Ed was supposed to implement goes directly to preventing those kinds of fraud and abuse that we've seen. And so, you know, it's all the more distressing that we see now the Department of Ed backing out from its obligation to implement this rule.
Right.
So,
can you talk about what your sense is of the Department of Ed's justification for the suspension of the rules? And Betsy DeVos has said, I believe, that it's necessary to suspend the Obama administration's rules on these loans because of a lawsuit by a group of not-for-profit colleges in California that were trying to block the rules.
Well, unfortunately, it's just, I think, symptomatic of where the agency is in terms of its priorities. Its priorities are not with students. Its priorities seem to be with private interests that stand to profit through education. And, you know, Betsy DeVos does not seem to be acting in the interest of students by taking such an action. And what we saw with her pulling out of this rule, or trying to, is really an effort to pull the rug out from students. I'm not surprised on some level, because it's simply followed a pattern of this administration, an administration that's chosen to side repeatedly with for-profit interests over the interests of students. And, you know, I view it simply as a betrayal of the responsibility of the Department of Education, and a betrayal of millions of students and families across this country. And that's why my office, joined by 18 other states, has sued and taken this action today, because we need to stand up for our students and we need to enforce the law. And what they've done is not just a violation of the law, because you simply can't buy a two-page notice without any time for comment or anything else, pull the rug out from under everyone. A rule is all set to be implemented after a thorough process.
Let's talk about another ruling. It's a different from a courthouse. Last Monday, a judge in Western Mass, it was Judge Richard Carey, he accused two former state prosecutors of misconduct in connection with the Sonia Farrick case, and she who stole and used drugs in Amherst, Massachusetts, at the state lab there. She was supposed to be testing these drugs. She ended up using them. Martha Coakley was then attorney general. But has your office reviewed the judge's decision, and did you have any knowledge of what he is alleging?
I can give you a little bit more background on that. The decision that came down is one that we're still reviewing. It involved a case that came in under a prior administration and involved questions about the operation of a lab in Western Mass. In addition, in the course of that, the judge made findings with respect to the conduct of former assistant attorneys general, and we're reviewing that decision right now.
So the prosecutor's job is one that's particular, and it is to get these convictions. I mean, as much as anybody is to clear somebody, you know, the defense is to clear. When prosecutors, if they willfully withhold information from the defense, it's known, as you know well, as the Brady violation. This is seen as a common reason for convictions to be overturned. Do you think that this is a problem within the courts here, within the former AG's office?
No, I don't. I don't. We disagree with the court's characterization with respect to this particular matter. But, you know, from my perspective, there's nothing more important than ensuring the integrity of the process and making sure that everybody, prosecutors included, play by the rules. And that's certainly what I expect and have seen out of my office and other offices. When there are instances or there are questions raised, they need to be addressed. And if the wrong steps were taken or the wrong actions were taken, then that needs to be addressed. But from a law enforcement perspective, it is really important that that the public be able to trust in the integrity of the process. And in fact, the whole system relies on mm-hmm. the integrity of the process and everybody doing their job.
Have you spoken in your review of the judge's decision to Martha Coakley?
No.
Will you be contacting her?
No. No, we'll review the decision and, you know, handle it as we would any matter.
And is there concern how it reflects on her office or on the AG's office overall?
No, not in my view. It again, this is a particular matter where a judge made a particular ruling with respect to a particular issue that was raised in the context of a broader case, which was about the conduct of Sonia Farak, the chemist who was conducting work at a lab then operated by the State Department of Public Health, now operated by the Massachusetts State Police. So this involves work from years earlier, and the important thing right now is that the right operations are in place, the right practices are in place. That needs to happen for the sake of criminal defendants, for the sake of our prosecutors, for the sake of our courts and the integrity of the system. And that's certainly something that I'll continue to, as Attorney General, work with all federal partners and state partners and local partners to ensure along every step of the way.
And I wonder about those local partners like the district attorneys or the law enforcement in the various places where people, defendants, are being let out of jail, like the few who were let out in Western Mass. So the fallout, the bigger picture, or another picture, is from the Farak case and Annie Dukan's case, who was another chemist who was involved in tainting evidence that convicted thousands, potentially, of people. There are defendants who could walk away who were wrongly convicted, and there are other defendants who will be let out of jail who should still be in jail. Is your office working with the courts, with the district attorneys around the state, in some plan to address what the fallout is going to be in probably the years ahead?
Well, we're going to have to see exactly what the scope of this is. At this point, we certainly will continue to work with our partners in government to make sure that the right steps are taken with respect to any cases that are out there or cases that may have gone through this lab.
I want to ask you finally about President Trump's travel ban. You were an early and vocal challenger of the ban. You've consistently fought back against anything revised or otherwise, calling his travel bans discriminatory and undermining the rule of the law. So last week, the Supreme Court partially reinstated President Trump's travel ban, and portions of it went into effect already. What is your take on the court decision, and what is next from your office?
Well, importantly, what the court left in place was a significant part of the ban, the stay, I should say, of the ban. And, you know, we're going to continue to be involved in this matter. It's going now before the Supreme Court, so we'll work with other states and be submitting briefs shortly to the Supreme Court so that it can take it up this fall.
Okay, Attorney General Maura Healey, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you.
Okay, nice speaking with you.
Take care. If you received what looks like junk mail from your city or town about your electricity, you might want to take another look before you toss it out. Residents around Massachusetts have been receiving these letters saying their municipality is switching energy suppliers. Cities and towns are allowed to do this on behalf of the residents, and it's under state law. The moves come as community leaders are seeking to buy more environmentally friendly power. But there is someone, the founder of ConsumerWorld.org, Edgar Dworsky. He is a consumer attorney, and he used to work at the Massachusetts Executive Office of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation in Boston. He says it's not necessarily a good thing.
In the case of Brookline and Winchester, consumers who were being switched into plans will wind up paying more on their electric bill every month because those city and towns chose plans that had more green energy supplies, if you will, from wind and solar than some other plans that were also available to them.
This is not a simple equation. This is depending on the city or town, the rates could go up by a few dollars a month or otherwise. Joining us now to understand this, if we can, is Larry Creshan. He is the executive director of the Mass Energy Consumers Alliance. Welcome to Radio Boston, Larry Creshan.
Hi, thanks very much.
And I just want to make sure we understand who you are. Your group is an advocacy group for clean energy?
Well, yes, we advocate for clean energy. We encourage the state and cities and towns to support clean energy, but we're also a supplier. We buy renewable energy wholesale from wind and solar generators, and we offer that to consumers who want to go above state law and voluntarily buy more renewable energy.
Okay, so you then would see this as a good thing as opposed to Edgar Dvorsky, I would imagine. But what is going on here, and why are people getting these letters now, this time of year in particular?
Well, there's been a spate of interest in the last year or two of a lot of communities want to either save money through community choice aggregation, or they want to incorporate more renewable energy into their mix. And some communities are trying to balance the two and try to make progress in both areas. And so what a lot of these communities have done is they've hired a consultant. In the case of Brookline and Somerville, the consultant is a company by the name of Good Energy that has helped organize this concept, which is they put it out to bid for the electricity supply, but with a specification that it include more renewable energy than required by law. And, we do support that. We think that communities are very accountable, that there's a process in according to state law where even the plan has to be approved by city officials or town officials. In Brookline's case, it was a town meeting. In Somerville, it was the mayor and the city council. But then there's a very deliberate process overseen by the Department of Public Utilities in Massachusetts where consumers are given that letter that you referred to, and they're given a chance to opt out. If they don't want more renewable energy than required by law, then they don't have to. They can decide to stick with the utility. And in those cases, it's Eversource, or they could pick another supplier.
But what about this idea that people are not, we don't know how many people don't realize that this is a place that they could opt out. Are you hearing from people that they were surprised by their supplier changing, that their bill did go up, or that they didn't even notice it? And this is just coming to light for some. Early June, one of the wicked locals had an article about Arlington, Massachusetts. We saw something in the Boston Globe, and we've been hearing about this ourselves. So, I mean, isn't this surprising for consumers? And shouldn't they know first?
Well, they do know first. I guess,
how informed are we, right?
Their community had a public process. There were public hearings, in any community when there's a active, civic engagement going on, some people are going to, for good reason, they may not be they may not pick up on the information. They may not be paying attention at a particular moment. But what we want to underscore is that, nothing was done sleight of hand. It took months to get through the Department of Public Utilities. Now what's happening, people are responding, and the Globe wrote a story about the fact that everyone got their 30-day opt-out letter, is what we call it. They're not going to see this on their bill until the first meter read in July or August. And so they're given a notice here that they can opt out of the renewable energy content if they want. But you know what? Even after the 30 days, they're allowed to opt out at any time that they want without penalty.
Okay,
so it's a sort of a grace period is what we have going on right now.
Okay, so everything, just to be clear, we know it is on the up and up. I think there is just sort of, who we are as consumers. We think we've signed on for Eversource or for National Grid or whomever, and that's just our electricity company for, from birth to death, if you're living in the same place.
Isn't it a good thing, though, that the community is now looking at what's going on with the electricity supply that the utility's providing?
It could be, but there, this is about municipal aggregation, right? But there's also in the aggregate that somebody is making a lot of money over time. Or there's $50 million, according to the Boston Globe. Let me read this straight out. Eversource estimates that residential customers who joined these programs, these municipal aggregation programs, have in the past 12 years collectively paid more than $50 million more than they would have if they had stuck with Eversource's basic service option. So where is that money going?
Well, first of all, I think we should take another look at Eversource's numbers, you know, that's something they're throwing out to the globe. But, you know, I haven't seen the mathematics behind that. But what's driving this in many cases is, again, they're going back over 12 years, over, you know, a couple hundred thousand customers, and that's interesting. The Cape Light Compact runs the oldest municipal aggregation program maybe in the country, and they're doing quite well, and they're saving more energy. They have an energy efficiency program down there that's producing great results for the people of Cape Cod, and that's part of that program, and Eversource isn't referring to that. They have nothing to gain or lose, as far as I understand it, by these programs.
Larry Krishan, we just have a little bit of time. I'm sorry. This is such a complicated story, it seems, because, you know, we just assume our utilities come in some way, whether that's green or otherwise. Is it in about 20 seconds, is it complicated always, or will we get used to this as a new way of deciding whether we opt in or out and how we pay our bills?
It's going to be done on a community-by-community basis. And, you know, the reality is a lot of communities want to address climate change and they want to build the renewable energy projects in the community. And one way to do it is by exercising this community choice aggregation.
Larry Krishan, thank you so much for joining us. I hope we get to continue talking about this. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, among others. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.